He displayed, moreover, in society, a great variety of gifts, played several musical instruments excellently, and sometimes showed facilities and powers which bordered on the mysterious and incomprehensible. For example, one day he had dictated to him the first 20 verses of a poem, and wrote them simultaneously with both hands on 2 separate sheets of paper. No one present could distinguish one sheet from the other. In order to arrive at some orderly sequence, it will be well to divide our material into 3 parts. Footnotes to this last pages. 1. Theories about his birth and character, with personal details, some of which we have briefly noticed. 2. His travels and knowledge. 3. His political and mystical work. Beginning, then, with our first division, the theories about his birth and nationality are many and various, and different authors, according to their prejudices, trace his descent from prince or tax gatherer, apparently as fancy dictates. Thus, among other parentages, we find him supposed to be descended from 1. The widow of Charles II, King of Spain, the father a Madrid banker. 2. A Portuguese Jew. 3. An Alsatian Jew. 4. A tax gatherer in Rotondo. 5. King of Portugal, natural son. 6. Franz Leopold, Prince Ragazzi, of Transylvania. This last seems to have been the correct view, according to the most reliable sources that have been found, and other information to which we have had access on this point. This theory is also held by Georg Hezekiel in his Abenteuerliche Gesellen, I. 35, Berlin, 1862. Karl von Weber, op. Sit. I. 318, also says that M. de Street Germain openly appeared in Leipzig in 1777 as Prince Ragazzi, and that he was often known as the Graf Saragi, which latter is merely an anagram for Ragazzi, Ragazzi. This last fact we have verified in another interesting set of articles, to which we shall refer later, written by a person who knew him at Anspach under the name Saragi. Another writer remarks, his real origin would, perhaps, if revealed, have compromised important persons. And this is the conclusion to which, after careful investigation, we have also come. Prince Karl of Hesse, writing of M. de Street Germain, says, some curiosity may be felt as to his history. I will trace it with the utmost truthfulness, according to his own words, adding any necessary explanations. He told me that he was 88 years of age when he came here, and that he was the son of Prince Ragazzi of Transylvania by his first wife, a Tekli. A well-known writer speaks on the same point, an author, moreover, who had access to the valuable Milan archives. We refer to the late Cesare Cantù, librarian of the Great Library in Milan, who in his historical work, Illustri Italiani, 2.18, says, the Marquis of San Germano appears to have been the son of Prince Ragazzi, Ragazzi, of Transylvania. He was also much in Italy. Much is recounted of his travels in Italy and in Spain. He was greatly protected by the last Grand Duke of Tuscany, who had educated him. It has been said that M. de Street Germain was educated at the University of Siena. M. De Genlis in her memoirs mentions having heard of him in Siena during a visit that she paid to that town. The whole life of M. de Street Germain seems to have been more or less shadowed by the political troubles and struggles of his father. In order to understand this, we must take a brief survey of his family history, a survey which will moreover give us some clues, helping us to unravel the tangled web of mysterious elements which surrounded the life and work of the great occultist. Few pages of history are more deeply scored with sorrow, suffering and impotent struggle than those which tell the life story of the efforts of one Ragazzi after another to preserve the freedom of their principality, and to save it from being swallowed up by the rapidly growing Austrian Empire under the influence of the Roman Church. In an old German book, Genealogus Archivarius Osdemjar 1734, pp. 409, 410, 438, Leipzig, a sketch is given, on the death of Prince Ragatsi, of his family, his antecedents and descendants, from which we will quote some leading facts. Francis Leopold Rakosi, or Rakatsi, according to the later spelling, the father of the famous mystic, made ineffectual efforts to regain his throne, the principality of Siebenburg era, and hence the son, Francis Leopold, was brought up at the court of Vienna. As our informant says, the widowed princess, who had remarried Graf Tekeli, was forced to hand over her children with their properties to the emperor, who said he would become their guardian and be responsible for their education. This arrangement was made in March, 1688. When, however, Prince Francis came of age, his properties, with many restrictions and limitations, were given back to him by the Emperor of Austria. In 1694 this Prince Ragatsi married at Köln, am Rhein, Charlotte Amalia, daughter of the Landgraf Karl von Hesse-Wachfried, of the line of Rheinfels. Of this marriage there were three children, Joseph, George and Charlotte. Almost immediately after this period Prince Ragatsi began to lead the conspiracies of his noblemen against the Austrian Empire, with the object of regaining his independent power. The history of the struggle is most interesting in every way, and singularly pathetic. The prince was defeated and all his properties were confiscated. The sons had to give up the name of Ragatsi, and to take the titles of Street Carlo and Street Elizabeth. Let us notice what Ezekiel has to say on this point, for he has made some very careful investigations on the subject. We are, in fact, inclined to think the Comte de Street Germain was the younger son of the Prince Franz, Leopold Ragatsi and the Princess Charlotte Amalia of Hesse-Wachfried. Franz, Leopold was married in 1694, and by this marriage he had two sons, who were taken prisoners by the Austrians and brought up as Roman Catholics. They were also forced to give up the dreaded name of Ragatsi. The eldest son, calling himself the Marquis of San Carlo, escaped from Vienna in 1734. In this year, after fruitless struggles, his father died at Rodostu in Turkey, and was buried in Smyrna. The eldest son then received his father's Turkish pension, and was acknowledged Prince of Siebenbürgen, Transylvania. He carried on the same warfare as his father, fought against and was driven away by Prince Ferdinand of Lobkowitz, and finally died forgotten in Turkey. The younger brother took no part in the enterprises of his elder brother, and appears, therefore, to have been always on good terms with the Austrian government. Adverse writers have made much mystery over the fact that the Comte de Street Germain was rich and always had money at his disposal. Indeed, those writers who enjoyed calling him a charlatan and a swindler did not refrain also from hinting that his money must have been ill-gotten. Many even go so far as to say that he made it by deceiving people and exercising an undue influence over them. If we turn to the old archivarius already mentioned, we find some very definite information that not only shows us whence the large fortune possessed by this mystic was derived, but also why he was so warmly welcomed by the King of France, and was so well known at all the courts of Europe. No obscure adventurer is this with whom we are dealing, but a man of princely blood, and of almost royal descent. Turning back to the old chronicle we find in the volume for 1736 The Will of the Late Prince Franz, Leopold Ragatsi, in which both his sons are mentioned who have been already named, and also a third son. It also states that Louis XIV had bought landed property for this Prince Ragatsi from the Polish Queen Maria, the rents of which property were invested by the order of the King of France in the Hotel de Ville in Paris. We also find that considerable legacies were left which were to be demanded from the Crown of France. The executors of this will were the Duke de Bourbon, the Duc de Maine and the Comte. Prince Ragatsi committed his third son, to whom also he left a large legacy and other rights on this valuable property. Hence we must cast aside the theories that M. de Street Germain was a homeless and penniless adventurer, seeking to make money out of any kindly disposed person. These were the views and ideas of the newspaper and review writers of that day, put forward in the leading periodicals. Unfortunately, the law of heredity prevails in this class of people, and there is a remarkable similarity between the epithets hurled by the press of the 19th century at the venturesome occultist of today and those flung at M. de St. Germain and other mystics of lesser importance and minor merit. We will now pass from this portion of our subject to some of the personal incidents related of M. de St. Germain. Perhaps the most interesting are those given by one who knew him personally in Anspach during the period that he was in close connection with the Markgraf. It appears that the mystic made two visits at different times to Schwalbach, and thence he went to Triesdorf. We will let the writer speak for himself on this point. On hearing that a stranger, both remarkable and interesting, was at Schwalbach, the Markgraf of Brandenburg, Anspach invited him to come to Triesdorf in the spring, and the Graf Sarajy, for this was the name under which he appeared, accepted this invitation, on the condition that they would allow him to live in his own way quite unnoticed and at peace. He was lodged in the lower rooms of the castle, below those occupied by Mademoiselle Cléion. The Markgraf and his wife lived in the Falkenhaus. The Graf Sarajy had no servant of his own. He dined as simply as possible in his own room, which he seldom left. His wants were extremely few, and he avoided all general society, spending the evenings in the company of only the Markgraf, Mademoiselle Cléion, and those persons whom the former was pleased to have around him. It was impossible to persuade the Graf Sarajy to dine at the prince's table, and he only saw the Markgraf in a few times. Although she was very curious to make the acquaintance of this strange individual. In conversation the Graf was most entertaining, and showed much knowledge of the world and of men. He was always especially glad to speak of his childhood and of his mother, to whom he never referred without emotion, and often with tears in his eyes. If one could believe him, he had been brought up like a prince. One day Sarajy showed the Markgraf an invitation which he had received, sent by a courier, from the Graf Alexis Orloff, who was just returning from Italy. The letter pressed Graf Sarajy to pay him a visit, as Graf Orloff was passing through Nuremberg. The Markgraf went with Graf Sarajy to Nuremberg, where the Graf Alexis Orloff had already arrived. On their arrival Orloff, with open arms, came forward to meet and embrace the Graf Sarajy, who now appeared for the first time in the uniform of a Russian general, and Orloff called him several times, Caro Padre, Caro Amico. The Graf Alexis received the Markgraf of Brandenburg, Anspach with the most marked politeness, and thanked him several times for the protection which the Markgraf had accorded to his worthy friend. They dined together at midday. The conversation was most interesting. They spoke a good deal of the campaign in the archipelago, and still more about useful and scientific discoveries. Orloff showed the Markgraf a piece of Unigny table wood, which when tested produced neither flames nor cinders, but simply fell to pieces in light ashes, after it had swollen up like a sponge. After dinner Graf Orloff took the Graf Sarajy into the next room, where they remained for some considerable time together. The writer, who was standing at the window under which the carriages of Graf Orloff were drawn up, remarked that one of the Graf's servants came, opened one of the carriage doors and took out from the box under the seat a large red leather bag, and carried it upstairs to the other room. After their return to Anspach the Graf Sarajy showed them, for the first time, his credentials as a Russian general with the imperial seal attached. He afterwards informed the Markgraf that the name Sarajy was an assumed name, and that his real name was Ragitsy, and that he was the sole representative and descendant of the late exiled Prince Ragitsy of Siebenbürgen of the time of the Emperor Leopold. So far this narrative is tolerably accurate, but after this point the author proceeds with the history of what he considers the unveiling of the notorious Comte de St. Germain, in which all the various theories about his birth, to which we have already referred, are retold with embellishments. Amongst other wild reports, it was stated that M. de St. Germain had only become acquainted with the Orloffs in London in 1770, whereas there are various historical proofs showing, without doubt, that he was in 1762 in St. Petersburg, where he knew the Orloffs well. We have moreover heard in Russia that he was staying with the Princess Marie Galitzin at Arkhangelskoy on March 3, 1762. The following details were found in Russia, and sent by a Russian friend. The Comte de St. Germain was here in the time of Peter III, and left when Catherine II came to the throne. M. Pylyf thinks even before Catherine's time. At St. Petersburg St. Germain lived with Count Rotari, the famous Italian painter, who was the painter of the beautiful portraits which are in the Peterhof Palace. The street where they lived is supposed to be the Grafsky Perelok. Perelok means small street, and Grafsky comes from Graf, Count, near the Anichkov Bridge where the palace is, on the Nevsky. St. Germain was a splendid violinist, he played like an orchestra. In the story of the Razumovsky family, Alexis R. was reported to have spoken of a beautiful moonstone St. Germain had in his possession. M. Pylyf has seen, he cannot remember where now, a piece of music, some air for the harp, dedicated to Countess Osterman by St. Germain's own hand signed. It is bound beautifully in red maroquin. The date is about 1760. M. Pylyf thinks that St. Germain was not in Moscow. He says the Yusupov family have many MSS. In old chests and that St. Germain was in relations with a Prince Yusupov to whom he gave the elixir for long life. He says, too, that St. Germain did not bear the name of Saltykov, Saltykov, in Russia but that in Vienna he did take this name. About the music signed by St. Germain, M. Pylyf now recollects that it belonged to him himself. He bought it at some sale and had it for some time. Then he gave it to the famous composer Peter Tchaikovsky as a present. It must now be in Tchaikovsky's papers, but as the great musician had very little order, M. Pylyf thinks it very unlikely that it could be found, especially as at Tchaikovsky's sudden death all was left without any directions being given about the property. We have said that the political events in his family had to some extent shadowed the life of M. de St. Germain. One remarkable instance of this we will now cite. It is, as far as we know, the only one in which he himself makes any direct reference to it, and it occurs some time later than the events which we have just been relating. After the return of the Markgraf from Italy, whither he had gone in 1776, and where he had heard some of the legends and fabrications above referred to, he appears to have sent the writer whom we have quoted to Schwalbach to see the Graf Sarogi, and to test his bona fides. We will continue the history as he gives it. On his arrival, he found M. de St. Germain ill in bed. When the matter was explained to him, he admitted with perfect coolness that he had assumed from time to time all the names mentioned, even down to that of Saltykov, but he said he was known on all sides, and to many people, under these names, as a man of honor, and that if any calumniator were venturing to accuse him of nefarious transaction of in the most satisfactory manner, as soon as he knew of what he was accused, and who the accuser was who dared to attack him. He steadily asserted that he had not told the Markgraf any lies with reference to his name and his family. The proofs of his origin, however, were in the hands of a person on whom he was dependent, that is the Emperor of Austria, a dependence which had brought on him, in the course of his life, the greatest espionage. When he was asked why he had not informed the Markgraf about the different names under which he had appeared in so many different places, the Graf Sarogi answered that he was under no obligations to the Markgraf, and that since he offended no one and did no person any harm, he would only give such personal information after and not before he had dealings with them. The Graf said he had never abused the confidence of the Markgraf, he had given his real name. After this he still remained at Schwalbach. A little later the author of the paragraph just quoted remarks, "What resources M. de St. Germain had, to defray the necessary expenses of his existence, is hard to guess." It appears curious to us that the writer knew so little of contemporary history. As we have seen, all the sons of Prince Rogozhsky were amply provided for, and the proofs were even more accessible than they are in our day. He goes on to say in conclusion, It would be an ungrateful task to declare that this man was a swindler, for these proofs are required and they are not to be had. This is truly an ingenious statement, but borders somewhat on libel. To speak of anyone as a swindler without any proof is beyond the bounds of ordinary fairness, and it is especially incongruous in view of the final paragraph, which is as follows. As long as the Graf had dealings with the Markgraf, he never asked for anything, and never received anything of the slightest value, and never mixed himself up in anything which did not concern him. On account of his extremely simple life, his wants were very limited. When he had money, he shared it with the poor. If we compare these words with those spoken of M. d'Estrées Germain by his friend Prince Charles of Hesse, we shall find they are in perfect accord. The only wonder is that a writer who speaks such words of praise can even hint that his subject might be a swindler. If such words can be rightly spoken of an adventurer, then would it be well for the world if a few more of like sort could be found. By Isabel Cooper, Oakley Trinisophia, the rarest of manuscripts. By Manly P. Hall from the Most Holy Trinisophia of the Comte d'Estrées Germain, introductions by Manly P. Hall, Phoenix Press, Los Angeles. For the utmost significance to all students of Freemason Y and the occult sciences is this unique manuscript, Latres Sainti Trinisophi. Not only is it the only known mystical writing of the Comte d'Estrées Germain, but it is one of the most extraordinary documents relating to the hermetic sciences ever compiled. Though the libraries of European Rosicrucians and Kabbalists contain many rare treasures of ancient philosophical lore, it is extremely doubtful if any of them include a treatise of greater value or significance. There is a persistent rumor that d'Estrées Germain possessed a magnificent library, and that he prepared a number of manuscripts on the secret sciences for the use of his disciples. At the time of his death, or disappearance, these books and papers vanished, probably into the archives of his society, and no trustworthy information is now available as to their whereabouts. The mysterious Comte is known to have possessed at one time a copy of the Vatican manuscript of the Kabbalah, a work of extraordinary profundity setting forth the doctrines of the Lucianiasts and the Gnostics. The second volume of The Secret Doctrine by H. P. Blavatsky, pp. 582-83 of the original edition, contains two quotations from a manuscript supposed to be by the Comte d'Estrées Germain. The parts of the paragraphs attributed to the Hungarian adept are not clearly indicated, but as the entire text deals with the significance of numbers, it is reasonable to infer that his commentaries are mystical interpretations of the numerals 4 and 5. Both paragraphs are in substance similar to the puissance des numbers de Pythagore by Jean-Marie Ragon. The Mahatma Kutumi mentions a ciphered miss by d'Estrées Germain which remained with his staunch friend and patron the benevolent Prince Charles of Hesse, Castle, see Mahatma Letters to A.P. Sinnett. Comparatively unimportant references to d'Estrées Germain, and wild speculations concerning his origin and the purpose of his European activities, are available in abundance, but the most exhaustive search of the work of 18th century memoir writers for information regarding the Masonic and metaphysical doctrines which he promulgated has proved fruitless. So far as it has been possible to ascertain, the present translation and publication of Latres Sainti Trinisophi affords the first opportunity to possess a work setting forth, in the usual veiled and symbolic manner, the esoteric doctrines of d'Estrées Germain, and his associates. Latres Sainti Trinisophi is misnumber 2400 in the French Library at Dreux. The work is of no great length, consisting of 96 sleeves written upon one side only. The calligraphy is excellent. Although somewhat irregular in spelling and accenting, the French is scholarly and dramatic, and the text is embellished with numerous figures, well drawn and brilliantly colored. In addition to the full page drawings, there are small symbols at the beginning and end of each of the sections. Throughout the French text there are scattered letters, words, and phrases in several ancient languages. There are also magical symbols, figures resembling Egyptian hieroglyphics, and a few words in characters resembling cuneiform. At the end of the manuscript are a number of leaves written in arbitrary ciphers, possibly the code used by Street Germain's secret society. The work was probably executed in the latter part of the 18th century, though most of the material belongs to a considerably earlier period. As to the history of this remarkable manuscript, too little, unfortunately, is known. The illustrious Freemasonic martyr, the Comte Alessandro Cagliostro, carried this book amongst others with him on his ill-fated journey to Rome. After Cagliostro's incarceration in the Castle San Leo, all trace of the manuscript was temporarily lost. Eventually Cagliostro's literary effects came into the possession of a general in Napoleon's army, and upon this officer's death Latres Sainti Trinosophi was bought at a nominal price by the Bibliothèque de Trouz. In his Musée des Sorciers, Grillet de Givry adds somewhat to the meagre notes concerning the manuscript. He states that the volume was bought at the sale of Messina's effects, that in the front of the book is a note by a philosopher who signs himself